Hello and welcome to another episode of the Send Mum Club podcast. I'm your host, Gemma. Hello to you if you're a new listener. Hello to you if you've listened to every single episode so far. I'd love to know if there is anyone who's listened to every single episode. I'd love that. So this is a parenting podcast with a difference because it is all about children with Send in all its forms. And I mean, that's such a huge umbrella, isn't it? Now, currently my situation is that my eldest, Alfie, who's 17, is looking after my youngest, Leo, who is 2.5. I mean, this is the benefit of having such a big age gap and it being the school holidays. So hopefully that will go swimmingly well. I would imagine there isn't much educating and enriching going on. I'd imagine currently there is quite a lot of Bluey going on because Leo is obsessed with Bluey, which actually I'm fine with. I very definitely edged him not towards Peppa Pig personally because I can't stand it. We are a Bluey household and I'm almost 100% positive that that is what is going on downstairs right now while I sit up here and record another podcast episode for you. And this one I loved. So I had a brilliant chat with Jessie Townsend. Now, you might already follow Jessie on Instagram. She posts some excellent content. And we were talking about her son, Max, who is 7, who has high functioning autism. But what we were actually talking about was the fact that he has PDA, which stands for pathological demand avoidance, which I'll be honest with you, I had never heard of before I found Jessie's Instagram. This chat definitely educated me on quite a lot of things, and obviously specifically PDA, but we also talk quite in depth about the issues that Jessie has had finding Max the right school. And I say issues, that almost downplays it, because this is a full battle that she's had, which I know is going to resonate with so many people listening, because unfortunately Jessie's not alone in how difficult she's found it to find a suitable setting for Max to go to school. So regardless of what diagnosis your child has, maybe they haven't even got their diagnosis yet, I think a lot of people are going to find this chat quite validating and actually really helpful. And it does have a very positive outcome, which I always feel is quite important to hear if you're really in the thick of it. So yeah, we spend quite a bit of time talking about the school system and, I mean, the fact that it's not great really, is it, how it's set up. We also talk about how that battle affected the rest of Jessie's family, because Max has a twin brother and an older brother. So the toll it took on them. And also with a diagnosis like PDA that a lot of people haven't heard of. And as Jessie said in this episode, a lot of people don't actually believe to be a thing how hard it is to find support in that situation and how important it is and how necessary it was for her to really advocate for Max and how hard that was at times. I think you're going to really enjoy this episode with Jessie. So let's get into it. Jessie, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, thank you for inviting me, Gem. I love talking about PDA, but it's just great to start really spreading the word about it because I feel like it's really misunderstood.
I mean, to be honest, and we will get more onto this in a minute, but it's something that I had never even heard of until I came across your Instagram a while ago. You've got 3 children, haven't you?
Mm-hmm. Yep. 3 boys.
Leon, who's 16, and then twins, Jake and Max, who are 7. And we are here predominantly to talk about Max, aren't we? Mm-hmm. So before we get into like a diagnosis and exactly, you know, what we're here to talk about, just tell me a little bit about him. Like, what's he like?
Maxie is the funniest kid ever. Like, literally, he has the biggest heart. He's just really, really funny. But he's also, we've always kind of said, it's like, this sounds really weird, well, it doesn't sound weird, but we have always kind of thought that he's like on a second life. He's like a really serious old man to a certain extent. He has a very, very different viewpoint on everything, the way he views it. And I think as time has gone on, it's become very apparent that is because of his ASD and his PDA. You know, he's very different to the other children, which is great, but also it comes with quite a lot of challenges and struggles for us as a family.
Yeah. You mentioned ASD there, but I've seen that you've described that as high functioning autism. Will you just, for those that don't know, just explain what the high functioning part of autism, because obviously everybody's heard of autism. Some people experience it. Some people have listened to me talk to other people with children with autism. But just explain the high functioning part.
So for us, we actually didn't. This sounds again quite a naive sort of. Well, not even a judgment, but for us, you know, Maxie hit all of the developmental parts that he should have at the right time. There was no cause for concern. But we did start to notice sort of some incredible memory reflexes that he would remember. Like, my in-laws live in West Oxfordshire, so they're about 120 miles away. From quite a young age, he knew exactly how to get there in the car. Sort of quite obsessive traited behaviour. But we actually didn't have any cause for concern. Our experience of a child who's got autism is, you know, was generalized by the, you know, a non-verbal child, or maybe they look autistic, which now looking back is a dreadful way to view, you know, how you expect somebody who's autistic to be. But in terms for Maxie, we really started to notice his different behaviour from probably about 3.5. When the whole sort of, it was put on our radar when they were at nursery, they were saying he's got some really funny little traits, you know, he likes to line things up all the time, he gets obsessed. And we were just like, oh, he's just the youngest. He's just, and that's because he's a twin. We, obviously, he's a twin brother, and he's got an older brother. But we kind of just really put it down to the fact that it was very different from Jake because he's a twin and they've spent every single day of their life together. And we don't know any twins either. So for us, the high functioning, we didn't expect that to come back on his diagnosis in any way, shape or form. We just thought PDA, he would get diagnosed with a PDA profile, but it has to fit in with ASD. But actually the primary diagnosis, they diagnosed him with high functioning ASD pretty much from the second or the first or second observation. And we were a bit like, you know, he avoids eye contact. He likes to socially take part, but when it comes to being in sort of a setting, he doesn't really like that. He really thrives. And I think the biggest sort of trait that now reflecting back on sort of maybe 4 or 5 years ago was actually his relationship with peers and with adults. Like, he's way more in tuned with adults. Like, in terms of his function, how he functions, he can really string a conversation at a much higher level than his twin brother can, Jake.
I don't want to put words into your mouth, but would I be correct, just based on what you've just said, that doesn't necessarily affect everyday life in a significant way?
No, not at all. It doesn't affect him. If there was no demand avoidant profile, then, you know, Maxie would probably be able to attend mainstream primary school. He can cope. You know, sometimes, you know, he is sensory sensitive though, so quite loud noises and busy places are sometimes only the biggest giveaway that in terms of their high functioning ASD that we do see. Like, it's a bit of a rock and a hard place. We can't work out if it's the demand avoidance or if it is actually the high functioning, because he gets quite overwhelmed quite quickly.
Let's talk about the PDA. What does that stand for?
So it stands for pathological demand avoidance. I mean, it is a terrible, terrible description. And it basically means that he suffers from a loss of autonomy. So he has to be in control, because if he doesn't feel in control, they suffer from a sense of injustice. So they need to feel equal, and basically they need to be at the top of the hierarchical command of everything. So even something as simple as when they're watching the television, if he is not in control of the TV remote and somebody else wants to have a go, he feels that he's really hard done by effectively. So anything that causes loss of autonomy, basically, you know, children with PDA will generally fall into the way they respond. They fall into fight, flight or freeze because it's a nervous system disability. For us, Maxie has always been an externalizing PDA. So he goes into fight mode. So, you know, very quickly, very early on, like he doesn't sit in the corner and he doesn't, you know, he doesn't mask, he doesn't sort of cover it up. He can't cover it up. Whether or not that's more swayed towards the fact that he's a boy, I think sometimes that some of the parents that I've spoken to, a lot of girls can generally tend to sway between masking. So for us, I would say, like, going back to what you just said a minute ago, like you said, the high function ASD would not really, if he didn't have a trait of a demand avoidance profile also, we probably wouldn't be at a specialist school or experience the sort of chaos that we've been through for the last 3 years, because he would be able to function at that high, you know, at that high functioning complete. But it's the demand avoidance that has removed him from mainstream school.
So you said that that's a nervous system thing and how his brain works. But am I right in thinking that presents as behavioural though?
Yes. So if you were out and about, so say, Jen, we were out in the street and you saw us and Maxie was having, you know, and he had a loss of autonomy, he would start potentially, because he's an externaliser, so he, all hell breaks loose with Max when he, you know, when he loses control, he would look like probably like just a kid that's got no discipline, running around, kicking, hitting, spitting. When they start to boil up, it's the only way that they can channel their, channel the stress that they've got of the nervous system disability. A part of their brain is, you know, sending a warning to them all the time that they are, you know, that they are, that this is a really scary environment for them. So the only way, you know, like I said, they can go into fight, flight or freeze. For Maxie, for us, he goes into fight mode. It's very, I think, well, he's seven. I think he's only ever, he's never done a runner. He ran off once, but he very rarely is very reserved and sort of, he doesn't go into flight mode. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't freeze. He's not very quiet. He will always, which is a good, which is as chaotic as it is, it's been good evidence, quality evidence when he was in mainstream school that he couldn't attend, because the reality is if you're a disruptive child with ASD or any form of neurodiversity, you are removed much quicker than a child who is masking. That's just unfortunately the reality.
I mentioned that I'd never heard of this. Had you heard of it before you were dealing with it?
Absolutely not. But I think the irony in this, Gem, is that actually PDA has been around for a very long time. It's been around from like the late 70s, like the early 80s. They were doing a lot of work on it. There is a lot of parents that feel that their children, you know, is it going to be a primary diagnosis? Probably not, because it's not in a DSM-5 manual, which is obviously the manual that dictates all diagnoses, which all healthcare professionals worldwide basically work against. But for us, we had never heard of it. But now reflecting back, I probably went to school with children that had it, but they were just seemed as naughty, disruptive kids. And this is that the research in the early 80s was saying, yeah, my child, you know, the high when I think about Max and the high functioning, yeah, there is high functioning. And actually, it would never be an issue. But there was always, and I say this all the time, it's like, it's like trying to get a round peg into a square hole. There are a few traits, but something is just not quite right with a full, for us, even because Maxie's got ADHD, he's got hyperfocus ADHD, and even with the high functioning ASD, something was still, if they'd have just said that and the demand avoidance hadn't have been profiled and we didn't know anything about it, you know, parents left thinking there's something just not quite right here. These traits and these behaviours don't quite fully match what you're diagnosing. There's just something not quite right, like the explosive behaviors. And obviously neurodivergent children do get over, you know, do get overwhelmed, do get, you know, they are sensitive to noises, to smells. But with PDA, it can be so extreme, the demand avoidance, and, you know, it can be really violent and the language can be really, really offensive. But we'd never heard of it. We had never heard of it until the twins were in the when they moved up in nursery to the preschool sort of room. They were obviously starting to get mixed with another class, and they were sort of prepping them for reception. Now, because the twins are born in October, they were starting school incredibly late. We were just thinking, oh, they're going to be the oldest. Like, they're just really bored at nursery. You know, there's only so many times you can stick bits of pasta on sugar paper and all that sort of stuff. Do you know what I mean? And it can be quite monotonous, isn't it, nursery? And there was a few quite serious incidents where Maxie just didn't like being told what to do. And if he was told what to do and he had to conform, then we were seeing, you know, things being thrown across the playgroup room. We were seeing nursery assistants were, I think he broke about 4 or 5 pairs of his nursery assistants' glasses because they were obviously trying to pick him up to calm him, and that's the first thing that he was grabbing. Yeah. So then
his speedy toddler hands.
Yeah, speedy toddler hands. So then it was kind of, you know, he was sort of removed a couple of times out of the main room, and he was told, you know, and he went and sat with the nursery assistant, who, you know, the nursery manager, and she was amazing. But then that's when we started noticing like the really sort of odd behaviour. Well, not odd behaviour, but things just weren't quite right. He got obsessed with birds for about 6 months, and he had this book, and he pictures of birds, and he had to take his bird book everywhere with him. And we just kind of thought, oh, it's just, you know, it's a comfort thing. And then we got a phone call one day, and the nursery manager said, look, he's thrown a couple of chairs around. Is there any chance you can come and collect him? And I was like, yeah, okay, that's fine. And one of the assistants came out, and she said to me, she said, I just want to have a chat with you, because we got on really well with them all. We had a really great relationship. Our oldest son went there also. And she said, have you heard of PDA or any sort of demand avoidance? And I was like, no, not really. And when she said it, I thought, well, this is a bit of a weird thing to say. And she said, oh, look, my eldest son's got it. And she said, it might just be worth you having a read about it. And we kind of were like, oh, yeah, okay. But again, for us, with neurotypical children, we were kind of, okay, we kind of just don't think that he fits into that sort of, like, we just don't think that's right. Because, again, he hit all the developmental milestones. The health visitors weren't fast. You know, he obviously had jabs and all that stuff. And we were like, you know, every medical development check that he'd gone for, everything was absolutely fine. And then it got quite out of hand, maybe towards the end of, like, the Easter term, because I took them out of nursery for the summer to spend the summer with them before they started in reception. And they said, oh, they just wanted the primary school that the boys had gotten into, obviously our eldest son had gone into, and the Senko said they just wanted to come in, like, observe him at nursery. And we were like, yeah, that's fine. And they sort of said, oh, yeah, we think he'll be absolutely fine. He, like, come to mainstream. And I was thinking, this is all a bit weird. But then he started school in the September. And then that is when we just saw a catastrophic explosion of behaviour. Because obviously in nursery, if they don't want to do something, they don't have to do it, Jem. You know what I mean? They can just go off and do something else. But I think when they were trying, the sort of the triggers at nursery were being having to sit down and eat together. That, you know, there is some things at nursery that he had to do together. The non-negotiable, like when they all went outside, or when they all sat down for dinner, for lunch, when they all had snack time, you know, or when they all, if they were going to watch a film, and it was those type of incidents which really we probably should have paid a little bit more attention. But because, again, we did not feel that there was any developmental milestones missing, we were a bit like, meh, it's just, you know, they're old, they're going to be the oldest in their year nearly. And then they started reception, and it was an absolute car crash. It was very apparent by the October half term that something was seriously not quite right. And again, the Senko at the school, at their mainstream school, said, look, have you heard of PDA? And I said, well, actually, I have. This is now the second or third time it's been mentioned. And she said, look, I think we need to get, like, MindWorks in, like CAMS, and just let's do an observation on him. At this point, he was already, I think, after about a month of being in reception, it was too overwhelming for him. There's 30 kids in a class. Infants was a complete open plan sort of layout. So there was, you know, 90 kids. And by October half term, he was already been removed from class and had a TA and was doing, you know, his own work separate from the rest of the class. But he was finding it difficult to just conform with how mainstream school, you know, how rigid it is. And it is rigid.
Listening to you talk about all of that, I know that there's still a hell of a long way to go. And I haven't experienced the school system in terms of a child with additional needs yet. Because my older two are neurotypical. My son Leo has Down syndrome. And he's only 2.5. So we aren't there yet. But obviously I read things and I talk to amazing women on this podcast about the school system. And obviously there's stuff in the news this week or the week we're recording about potential reduction in EHCPs and things like that. However, it was interesting what you said, I think, about how long this has been around for and children being labelled as naughty. So we obviously have come on leaps and bounds, because if you think how many children that maybe we would have gone to school with, or children that you've heard about going, oh, they're just really naughty, they don't listen, they won't sit
still.
Like
they're throwing stuff. I mean, and I'm 45 and I can distinctly, there was three boys in my tutor group that were disruptive, they were naughty, they were back chatting, they threw stuff, they were always fighting, you know, they were reluctant, they were resistant to anything. And I look back and I said to my husband Darren, I tell you what, those three lads, I said, I can guarantee you that I went to school with had demand avoidant profiles, but they, because it's not a diagnosis, no, and this is going back in the 90s, there's absolutely no chance, you know, and kids were just expelled, you know, expelled and off you went to a Pru, you went to an alternate provision and that was it, you know. And this is the other thing, Maxie obviously went off to a Pru, and I was like, oh my God, it's like a school for naughty kids, because that was my experience of when I was at school. But actually, as you know, as the years have gone on, it's become very apparent that there are a lot of children that are in the mainstream education system that are more than likely to have a PDA profile. But if the, you know, we are very lucky that the mainstream school were very hot on PDA and they had a really good, thorough and sound knowledge and understanding of it, because that is key to getting the support and advice that you need from school, because you do need to get school on side. Yeah. And if, you know, and I, you know, I've got a big Instagram following, and a lot of the parents, I would say probably 50% of the parents that contact me, the school, there's just no buy-in. The school are like, no, we don't believe it. It's not a legit diagnosis. And again, it depends on where you live in the country. There's people up north that have got, you know, there's people in Liverpool that have had from the NHS a diagnosis and it's got PDA. It actually has pathological demand avoidance in it. There are people who are only in West Sussex, and that West Sussex are like, nah, it's not a thing. So then it's really difficult. It's inconsistent across the country. So there's no wonder schools don't understand it.
Absolutely. And it shouldn't be different depending on where you are, or, absolutely, you know, if not. You're in the school up the road down from the other one. But I do think I'm taking it as a positive hearing what you're saying. I'm taking it as things have moved on, definitely not to where they need to, but there is movement, because I think the fact that you said it had been mentioned to you two or three times by that October half term of, you know, reception. Yeah. And it was people coming to you, not you saying, oh, you know, can I get an assessment, or please, can you help me? They're saying it to you.
And here's the thing is, Jem, like, his behaviour was sometimes questionable when he was at home up until mainstream school, you know. But they're, again, they're siblings, they're boys, they're twins. Let's be honest, siblings always fight. They're twins. They are always tit for tat. Like, they kill each other, but they'll kill for each other. Like, the boys are like a little old married couple. Do you know what I mean? They tit for tat and they argue, and then they're, I love you, and blah, blah. And then they're biting each other and punching. So there was a level of, is this just sibling rivalry? Is this just normal siblings? Is this twins? But the catastrophic behaviour change, and it was awful for a while, was from the moment he started school. But he always wanted to go to school, but his nervous system, when he was there, he just couldn't cope with it. And that is quite a common trait. There will be triggers at some point within their life, whether or not they manage to mask the entire way through primary and then they get to secondary. You know, you can sometimes, you can cruise through primary school to a certain extent, but then you get to secondary school and it's very results driven, exams, conformity, uniforms, you've got to be somewhere at a set time, you're not being escorted around. So it can be, you know, these things can then start, and this is when they can't hide it, that they then go into burnout and they just can't do anything.
What were the next steps after this then? So you got your diagnosis when he was how old? The full diagnosis?
The full diagnosis was only about a year ago.
Oh, really?
But because his behaviour was so out of control, he needed to be removed. But we knew very early on, when they started school and it got just so much worse in the space of literally about 3 months, his behaviour at home was unbearable as well. He was violent. Then he was getting like somatic somatic sickness and illnesses, like he's constantly having a tummy ache. And he was then obviously trying to tell us that he just couldn't cope with school. And like I said a minute ago, the good thing about having an externalizing PDA is that he was a danger to himself, but he was also a danger to the other children. So in terms of safeguarding, he couldn't continue to stay at school. Okay. Obviously, they've got a legal requirement to educate my child full time. So CAMHS came along, they observed him, and they were like, yeah. At this point, we hadn't even been to the GP about a diagnosis. We're going back, 3 years now? And school, because it hadn't changed then, school were like, we can put you on the pathway very quickly because he's a danger to himself and a danger to other children.
Okay, so that puts him up the list.
That speeds it up quite quickly. Okay. Then he started to get exclusions and suspensions because they had to exclude. I mean, he nearly pushed a fridge over onto like a load of little kids that were sat at a table. You know, the reality is, you know, it's a double sized fridge, a big American sized fridge where they used to keep all the snacks in reception. Now, if that would have gone over, you know, that could have been a really serious incident.
Yeah.
But then obviously they had to exclude him, which obviously as a parent, you can refuse the exclusion. But for us, it was just, you know, we had the family outreach team in touch by this point, and they were amazing at supporting us. And they said, you know, you can refuse this. But we were like, what is the actual point? If he's that upset and behaving like this, then we don't actually really want him to go to school and get that upset. His attendance had then started to drop. So the caveat is less than 70% attendance. And not safe to themselves, it goes quite through quite quickly.
Okay.
But obviously it was still a 2-year process. But he went back after Christmas and it just still wasn't working. So school then sort of sat us down and said, look, for Surrey, this is the next steps. We want to send him to a pupil referral unit as a step. And I was a bit like, oh my god, are you joking me? Like I just said, I was like, Jesus Christ, this is where naughty kids go that get excluded. And I remember I was actually at work and I was sat with my mate and I was thinking, like, Jesus Christ, like, this is, you know, I don't want him to go to this school. This is like schools where kids go, that are feral, that are really awful, and now you're saying that my 5-year-old kid's got to go there. Anyway, when we spoke to the school mainstream Senko, she said, listen, if you refuse this, Prue, Surrey Council are going to say, well, you've had your chance. This is it. Either goes or he doesn't. So after a bit of umming and ahhing, we spoke to the head teacher at the Prue, who was amazing. And she said, look, come and see us, like, bring him with you. And we arrived, we went to go and see it the next week. And, you know, at this point it was December. We went to go and see it the next week. And I was like, oh my God, wow. And, you know, they had a therapy dog. There was only like 5 kids in a class. There was like 2 TAs and a teacher per class. There was like, no, I don't think there was even more than 30 kids in the entire Prue.
Oh, wow.
And it was amazing. And Max loved it. He was really nervous when we went in, but he was just like, his face lit up and they were chatting to him. So then we said, he'll go. So he went for it the entire term, from when they returned back after Christmas to Easter. You know, there was a few bumps along the way for about 2 weeks. It was a bit of a nightmare. You know, it's just settling in. You know, we're sending a 5-year-old kid off in a car because he got transport in a car. By himself, like, for 15 miles, like, he just got straight in. That's that shift of that high functioning. He's very grown up to a certain extent, and things really don't bother him when he feels comfortable. Off he went, and, you know, 2 weeks later, he was a model student for the entire term. Then he had to come back to mainstream. So through that whole period of him being at the Prue,
is that only a temporary thing?
Yeah. Unless you've been permanently excluded, so for Surrey, and it's very different. It's inconsistent because it's driven by it's decided by the local authority. So dependent on, the Prue in Surrey was, if he didn't have an EHCP, and at this point he still did not have an EHCP because it was so early on, and you've been permanently excluded from school, or you need it was a short term interim to see if you can transition back to mainstream. Basically, what they wanted to try and do was see if they could give Max the key skills and strategies that they use there to allow him to go back to mainstream school. Because the reality is, they don't want to be paying for these kids out of school because it costs the local authority. That's the other
thing. Yeah, of course. I mean, I understand that, but that's giving children those skills within that setting, isn't it?
Yeah, totally.
That's completely different to, oh, we'll go back to where you were before then.
Yeah, exactly. So we'd learned all this stuff, and his teacher from mainstream, like, they'd visited him, and obviously the teachers had visited school to see if they could sort of suggest some stuff. And I remember we had a phone call with the head from his PRU, and she sort of said to me, I'm going to be really honest with you, I don't think it's going to work when he goes back to mainstream. And she again was like, he's definitely got PDA. She said, you know, he's so intelligent, he's so quick, she said, that high functioning, but she said, just the layout of the school, the class sizes, just how it is. She said, I'm going to be really honest with you now, Jess. She said, I just don't think it's going to work when he goes back. And we were like clutching on straws. We were like, yeah, it'll be fine. So obviously he went back after Easter. Oh my God, it was a nightmare. It was, you know, all, like you just said, all the hard work that he'd done and developed, and, you know, all these skills and strategies he'd learnt, just were thrown out the window after about 3 days. I think he went back to mainstream after, I'm laughing now because I look back and it was absolutely traumatic. I think he was back for a week and a half, and he got a 7-day exclusion. So then it makes him feel like shit because you know, he's only five. You know, he's just coming up to, you know, he's nearly six at this point. You know, he can work out. He's too little. He just kept on thinking, because then, you know, I get it, they have to exclude them. But for the child, it makes the child then feel that they're in the wrong. When actually, it's not his fault. He can't control it. He's got a nervous system disability.
At this point, how are you feeling? Because that's a lot, isn't it? That must feel like...
Well, it was a lot to happen in quite a short period of time, considering it became very apparent that the school, it was mainstream school that had made everything just literally 20 times worse in the space of about a month. It became very apparent. So then we were just like, oh, what are we going to do, next steps? And then, so basically, obviously, then we were winding down for reception going into the summer holidays. And we kind of said, look, listen, maybe, you know, let's just put him, he's been on a reduced timetable anyway. So we just sort of said, oh, you know, maybe we'll just send him in a couple of days a week, or we'll send him in half days. And they were like, yeah, it's coming to the end of term. They've never been at school really. So we reduced him pretty much down. I think by the time he went back, we sort of muddled along up until that second half term in the summer term, up until like the start of June. And again, it just wasn't working. So we sort of said, look, why don't we just reduce him down? I'm lucky I get the opportunity to get, you know, I can have the summer holidays off of work. And I sort of said, look, it's not an issue. We'll just wind him down. And so then we just, you know, there was a part of us that just kept on thinking, you know, is it just a shock of starting school? And then at this point, you know, the EHCP stuff still hadn't been sorted, and we were like, oh my God. But it had been started. We'd been allocated a case officer. So then we went back and for year one, and that was just an absolute car crash from, you know, the really weird thing, Gemma, was, you know, I'd been off to see my best mate who lives in Abu Dhabi, and I'd taken all three boys by myself. And, you know, we were gone for 3.5 weeks, and we had two meltdowns in 3 weeks, like, because there was no demand. We were just plodding along, doing our own thing. Do you know what I mean? And I got back and I said to my husband, you know, I'm starting to feel really nervous now. So basically the summer before they started school, when they were, this is another thing, like Max, he kept on getting this like insane issue that he needed to go to the toilet. And I am not joking you, he was going to the toilet like literally 50 times a day, and it was the nerves building up. He had it the summer that they had off when they left nursery to go to secondary, and it all kind of disappeared. I mean, we've been to the hospital, they thought he had diabetes, I mean, really, but it's actually his nervous system. And then when we got back from the Middle East, it started again on the prep, going like the anxiety was starting to get, he was starting to get more anxious, and the toilet and needing to go to the toilet started again. And I said to my husband, this is him. This is his body and his nervous system telling him that he does not want to go back to school. So we went back to school in the September, and I think by literally about a month, he'd been excluded again, he'd been suspended, and we were just like, what are we going to do? And we decided to reduce them down to lunchtime, because we kind of felt that the lunchtime, the dinner hall thing, was like kind of swaying him a bit. So we muddled on with that, you know, and then we had the EHCP sort of had all gone through. But again, they were like, oh, he can just go to a mainstream school with an ASD unit. And we were a bit like, I don't know. We've been to look at a few. Then as soon as you sort of mentioned like a PDA profile, they were like, nah, can't take him. Like, it's just too, because it's child-led learning, like, they have to be in control. A lot of schools can't cater for it, not even ASD units. And we were like, oh, my God. And then after Christmas, he was basically going for about 3 hours a week.
Right.
And so we were then having to top it all up. You know, we're going into the back end of year two now, and we were like, what is going on? Like, this is, you know, this is 2 years has ticked by nearly. And we went to see a lot of schools. But again, you mentioned the PDA profile, and they're just like, nah, can't take them. It's just too specialist. We just don't have the resources. So we were like thinking, like, what? No, been home educating for nearly just, you know, coming up for 2 years. And it was, you know, we'd taken a massive financial hit. We were having to take unpaid parental leave. We were taking blocks of a holiday. We were paying for childcare the days we had to go to work. So all of a sudden we were like, my husband and I calculated the day, we must be about 19 grand out of pocket. Like, that's how much it cost us. You know, yeah, we got DLA sort of allocated to us, like awarded to us sort of halfway through the second year. But it's nothing prepared us for the absolute mental strain and psychological strain that it put on us as a family. You know, we had issues then with Jake, Max's twin, because he was like, why is he not at school? I don't want to be at school. So then we had this other battle. And then because Maxie was so upset all the time, it just caught, it was such hard work. You know, anybody in the house, like my eldest son, Leon, used to get the brunt of the stick. He was getting stuff thrown at him. You know, I was his only safe person. So it was just becoming a real nightmare. And then, yeah, we found an SEMH school basically. And I think previously there had been a few issues with it. And it had been closed, shut down and reopened. So we were really lucky, but we kind of really kicked off that we were just getting no movement from our local authority. They were just like, well, we just keep on looking at schools and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, well, no, this is not good enough. Like, we're talking 2 years nearly now that he's not been in full-time education. Like, this isn't on. And then because he'd obviously been to the Pru, we had this evidence then that a small classroom environment and a specialist school was the best place. So after two formal complaints to Surrey Council, and I complained to the local government and social care ombudsman, when it went back to panel for the third time, panel named the school that we wanted, because even they had rejected Max. We'd been to see them and they'd been to see him, and they were like, oh, we just don't know. We're an SEMH school. We don't know if it's the right, you know, we deal with trauma, children that have, you know, been through really traumatic childhoods. And we were like, no, we need him to go to the school. Like, he cannot just fall between the cracks. And then we got Surrey Council to name the school, and he's been there for, it'll be a year in October, and he's loving it.
Do you know what though? I think if people aren't able to advocate in the way that you did, that's a terrifying thought, isn't it? Because
I say all the time, when I speak to other people, I mean, it literally nearly gave me a nervous breakdown. And I am a really resilient person. Like, I probably pride myself on being pretty, like, one of the most resilient people that I know. And this nearly broke me. It was just, I think the issue that I had was that you are just a piece of paper. Your kid's just basically a fucking number to somebody. And if they don't like you, and the case officer's just a bit like, well, and when I then found out what panel is just a group of people sitting around a table, they just plonk your kid's paperwork on the table. They spend about 10 minutes per child, and they're like, nut, 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 yep. And that is how your child is treated. But also you're putting your trust and confidence in somebody that doesn't know you. They don't know your child. But somebody said to me very early on, one of my mum friends, who's got an older son who's non-verbal, she said, you need to be that parent that is so on their case. You do not stop harassing them, almost, that they just think, we've got to get rid of her because she is not going to stop. Because the danger, the reality is, Gemma, you just said it, there are plenty of parents that don't have the education, they don't have the fight, that English might not be their first language, yeah. And they're the ones who are just basically just going to get left on the shelf. And they're the ones that'll think, oh, they're all right. we don't hear from them. We'll just leave that kid. And this can go on for like 6-7 years. But I absolutely was not having it. I was like, no way am I having this. It's just because it becomes so stressful. You know, you shouldn't have to do it. But the reality is there's not enough schools. There's not enough case officers. You just get lost in the cracks. And then it's also disjointed. You know, the LA named the school last May. And then it was a nightmare actually getting him a start date because there was an issue between the school and the LA and the funding. They were saying, you know, and fair play, his SEMH school sort of said, look, you know, the reason why we rejected you is because we don't kind of feel that this is a social, emotional and mental health school. So it's an SEMH primarily and it's an all boys school. These children come from really traumatic childhoods, whatever that constitutes as. And they were like, for us, Maxi, you know, he doesn't come from a traumatic childhood. His trauma, though, is triggered from mainstream education.
You touched on it briefly, but what effect, like what toll do you think it took on your other children?
Oh, massive. I think there was a real wedge between our eldest Leon and him for quite a while, because at that point, you know, he's only 16 now, but you know, we know quick kids grow up quickly, don't they, as we know. But, you know, if I go back 3 years ago, Leon was only 13.
So then that's puberty and hormones and being a teenage boy, isn't it? Which is hard alone.
Yeah, really difficult. And then, you know, you've got a brother who, too, obviously to Leon, I think he kind of felt, well, he doesn't look any different. He doesn't stim. He might occasionally, you know, tap his foot if he gets a little bit nervous. But there's no non-verbal signs that they're, you know, you look at Moo and you don't feel that, you know, that you just say, oh, he's just not, you know, he's normal, he's neurotypical. And I think that was very difficult for Leon to try and fathom, you know, because then when Maxie switched, it was just like a switch, you know, telling him to F off, he'd spit, he'd kick, he'd scream, he'd shout, he'd want everybody out of the house. And it's quite difficult. Don't get me wrong, it's not perfect by any means now, but we are much quicker. Well, we know, obviously, the thing is that everything comes with experience, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I, you know, my husband and I were saying, God, you look at like how mental our behaviour was at some point, you know, and how we address things, because we didn't know either. And, you know, like I said to you, we never really heard of PDA until about 4 years ago. So it's been a massive learning curve for everybody. And there's still some family members that do totally struggle with it, that, you know, that switch, because, you know, there's generational upbringings, isn't there? How people have, you know, what their perception is of, you know, they may have only ever seen, I mean, by one family member, and I won't say it just in case my husband or my mother-in-law is watching, but she kind of said, oh, you know, I've watched Rain Man and, you know, Maxie's not like that. And I was thinking, and that's not disrespectful to her, but that generation, that's really the only exposure that they've got to somebody that is autistic, which is really wrong, because Rain Man, it's a small demographic of, you know, people that have got autism. It gives a poor example of, you know, I think just general society of how they view children with autism. They should look a certain way and they should speak a certain way. So, and I think that, you know, they're having more diversity in children's programs and just normal programs and diversity in shops, it makes so much more, many more people more aware of, actually, you know, this is a stereotypical version that you've got of somebody who's autistic.
Yeah, absolutely. But you don't realize how important that representation and diversity is until it's important to you.
Until you're there. Yeah. And do you know what I remember? And I will never forget this. So when Leon, our eldest, was young, he obviously CBeebies mad. And I remember watching something on CBeebies. They had a new presenter.
She had a limb difference, didn't she? I remember, because we're about the same age and our eldest are about the same age.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I remember thinking, wow, And I remember Leon was like, and he was quite taken back. He must have only been about 3 or 4, and he was quite taken back. And I remember thinking, wow, you know, good on the BBC. But now as the years have gone on, they've obviously got a presenter. He's got Down syndrome on it.
George.
On CBeebies. Yeah, George, that's it. We don't watch CBeebies anymore. Sorry, it's like it's gone very quickly. We're onto Cartoon Network now. And actually, the inclusion and diversity now on children's programmes is, and just generally I find in the UK, is that we are slowly getting there. Like even on Bluey, you know, Bluey's cousin's in a wheelchair. They've got people with disabilities in cartoons now, and there's more representation, which I feel stops a generation of society of being quite judgmental, because I think we've probably all been there.
Yeah. Course.
It's out and about with kids, and someone's made a sweeping statement or someone sort of said something and you're a bit like, whoa, do they have to look autistic for you to maybe not have this opinion of them just because they're, you know, refusing to do stuff?
Yeah, it's interesting you mention, I can't remember her name, that CBeebies presenter, but I remember at the time the BBC got complaints about that. They got complaints about having somebody who looked different on. And you just think, what is wrong with people?
Yeah, totally. And I remember that. But now, so we obviously then, there's obviously a big age gap between Leon and the twins. So there was quite a substantial amount of time where we didn't have to watch TPPs. And then the twins come along and we were like, wow, this is even more diverse than it's ever been, which is a great representation for people with disabilities, children that are, that neurodiverse, because actually I think a lot of the issue, I think some of the stress for us early on in the days were what people thought of you and how, because do you know what I mean? Yeah. When you're out and about. And
well, this is something I actually wanted to ask you, because as you know, you've explained the PDA presents as a behavioural thing.
Yes, totally.
If you are out and about, and you briefly mentioned this at the beginning, and he does have a meltdown, how do you deal with that as a mother? And secondly, how do you find other people's reactions to that?
You have to pick your battles wisely, straight up. Like, I would never make him come and do something with us. Sometimes it's unavoidable, though, because I am a mum, and sometimes I just have to pop to co-op or whatever, you know, life. But actually, it's about making that informed decision. Actually, is it something, if I need milk or pasta, can I just order it off Deliveroo? Yeah, I might have to pay an extra £2. But actually, the trauma of chucking all the kids in the car, getting out of the car, blah, 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 blah. Actually, it's about trying to manage that. But if we're on days out, you know, he wears a sunflower lanyard, but he doesn't really like it, because, you know, again, that high function, he's like, I know that I look different, and I know that this is like a warning sign to people. You have to let him lead a lot of the time, and that's how we get out of it. We don't try and push him into situations, but he needs to be in control. So if we go to the shop, he can hold the basket, he can get the stuff, he can take the shopping list, and he can choose everything. But then if we do have meltdowns, before it used to really, really bother me if somebody said something. But now, if it's a comment that's sort of made, it depends on if the comment's made towards me as the parent, because that's the issue. That's the difference. Sometimes the comment's made towards you as the parent or the child. I mean, if it's aimed at me, I don't care. I've worked with the general public for a very, very long time. So it's water off a duck's back to me. But I have an issue of when it's directed to him.
Yeah.
Regardless or not, if he's, you know, kicked somebody or he's told one of us to F off, he's only 7. Like, don't be commenting on my child and making like a... But I would just say, thank you so much for that lovely comment. I was like, he has got a nervous system disability. So while you're stood there judging... You know, he actually does have a disability. And then I just walk off.
Love that response.
Oh, you know, I've worked in customer service a very long time. We always say kill him with kindness. Because actually, a lot of the time, people want you to kind of like flare up and be a bit like, don't speak to me like that. And initially, I used to be like that. I'd be like, what are you fucking talking to my... Don't you speak to my son like that. But actually, all it does is then it aggravates the situation with the other person. It stresses out them. And also, it fires up you. And you end up... It's just not a way to... It's just not good for your own mental capacity, is what I've learned very early on.
I feel like I could actually speak to you for so long, but I'm very conscious of time and I know that you've got stuff to do after this. I've got so many more things I wanted to talk to you about, but we've run out of time. So I'm going to finish with the same questions that I ask everyone. And the first is, what's the best piece of advice that you've been given along the way?
The best piece of advice for Maxi is always be an advocate. I mean, because like you said earlier, there were times where I just felt like, oh my God. And I think Emma, my friend, who said to me, if you are in this pathway of trying to get an EHCP, trying to get a specialist school, you have to be the loudest person that you can be, because the reality is your child will fall between the cracks and they will get forgotten about. So as draining as it can be, I mean, we are in such a different place now to what we were 2 years ago, but purely because you have to advocate. You have to be the loudest person screaming from the rooftop, like, this is my child. You need to stop and listen. And the reality is, if you don't, they'll probably fall between the gaps.
And then what do you wish that you'd known when you got this diagnosis of PDA that you know now?
What do I wish I'd known? I just wish more teachers and education environments were more aware of PDA, because I do feel that when it comes to pathological demand avoidance, I just feel that a lot of them are written off quite early. It's a behaviour thing. Oh, they can't grow out of it. They're just naughty kids. And I think if I wish I'd known that first, I think it would make it a lot easier to try and like fathom yourself. Because before I was like, oh my God, is it just a level of difficultness? Have I just suddenly got, is it just really, really difficult? But actually it's not. And I wish I'd known that actually it is a nervous system disability. And is it going to get better? Of course it's not. It's a lifelong condition, but actually you can, if you make the right adjustments, you can make it a lot easier for yourself. Did that make sense? Yeah, I feel like I've just... Does that make sense? No, I was like, did I waffle on there,
No,
Gemma?
You didn't waffle at all. It made perfect sense.
Did it? I was just thinking, where am I going with this?
I did like a deep stalk on your Instagram before you came on. And I think you're posting some extremely helpful things on there for PDA, but maybe for some just behavioural difficulties in general. So if people aren't following you already, where can they find you on socials?
Follow me. I'm Mrs. Jessie Towns on Instagram. That's really my main handle.
And that's Towns with a Z, isn't it?
Yeah, Town, TOWNZ. All my content on those free. You know, I've got a paid closed community with about, I think there's 90 parents in it now, whereas that's, you know, much more way in depth. There's weekly lives, there's training, we've got a group chat that's constantly popping off.
And is that just for PDA?
Yeah, I would say all parents that have got children that have got a demand avoidant. I would say not oppositional defiance disorder, because that is something very different. But yeah, I mean, anybody can join it. They, you know, it's £17 a month. They can leave whenever they want. But I think the one thing that we really struggled with, and this is why I started my Instagram, was there is little or no support out there.
Yeah,
that's the thing. And actually, what I thought when I set up my Instagram, not even a year ago, I remember my husband saying, oh, I bet there's not that many of us about, because we hadn't met anybody. And now we're talking like 25,000 followers nearly. And PDA is everywhere, but they're being put into a small box of the majority is their naughty kids.
Well, I'm going to put the link to your Insta in the show notes.
Perfect.
So if anyone's listening, I know lots of people listen when they're driving or, you know, they can't write stuff down. That will be in the show notes. And the link to your community is in your bio on your Insta, isn't it? So, you know, if this has resonated with people or they are in the same situation as you, that's where to find that. Jessie, I've really enjoyed our chat. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you, Gemma.
That chat was so interesting, I thought. Like I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, PDA is something I've never heard of, and I'm actually really enjoying educating myself through these podcasts and hopefully other people as well. So that was something I've really enjoyed learning about, because it sounds quite, you know, traumatic, some of Jessie's story, but I'm glad that I have now been educated on that. That's probably a better way to put it. And it was interesting also to go like quite in depth in into the school system and, you know, kind of how broken things are and how difficult it can be, but also going through those difficulties to have a positive outcome and to know that Max is now thriving in his setting, although obviously it shouldn't take what Jessie's had to go through and her family to get there. If you aren't following Jessie already on Instagram, I will put that link in the show notes. So if you want to give her a follow, and maybe you have a child with PD and you're interested in joining her community or just getting some hints and tips on her Instagram, and her Insta is great. I wasn't just saying that because I was on a call with her. So that's it. Another episode done and dusted. I hope you enjoyed that chat as much as I did. As always, if you'd like to rate and review, that would be amazing. And if you aren't already, subscribe, follow, however it is that your podcast app works. That is free to do. It just helps more people to find the podcast, which is obviously exactly what I want to happen. So thank you for listening. And I will be back with a brand new guest next week.